as is spitting at them. But I had to show willing, Deacon said. Had to show I'm part of the gang. Didn't want anyone to think I wasn't loyal. Well, my aching belly muscles would certainly seem proof of that, Mal said. And here's a protein block. Deacons unwrapped the food stuff and held it up for Mal to munch on. Barbecue spare ribs flavor. Not Mal's favorite, but still, he did his best not to guzzle the whole thing in one go. He was starving hungry. When had he last eaten? He could barely recall. Meanwhile, Deacon said, whatever else they're saying about you, Mal, I remember what you did for me on New Casimir. If it weren't for you, I wouldn't be here today and still sucking air. That earns you some latitude, far as I'm concerned. Enough latitude, Mal said around a mouthful of protein block, that you'd untie these ropes and let me go? Nuh-uh, Deacon shook his head regretfully. Can't do that. Can't fault a man for asking. They know I've come to see you. I've asked for some time alone with you. They think I'm working you over. They find out I'd freed you, I'd be dead. That simple. Could always stage a fight. Maybe I freed myself, overpowered you, got away under my own steam. No, Mal, that ain't how this is going to play out. I'm showing you some compassion, but it has its limits. You're still a traitor in these people's eyes. In mine, too, if what I'm told is true. And what have you been told? Mal said. It's a mystery to me, that's for damn sure. What is this huge betrayal I'm being accused of committing? Been racking my brains and can't think of none. Deacon studied him skeptically. I can't tell if you're being straight or scamming. You can't surely be ignorant of your crime, I find that hard to believe. Trust me, if I knew what I'm supposed to be guilty of, I'd be the first to hold my hand up and admit to it. You really don't remember? Too bad. I'm sure it'll come back to you. You ain't even gonna jog my memory a little? Why? You'll find out when the time comes to face judgment for it, and it's coming soon. Might be best if you just acclimatize yourself to that reality. Mal could see he wasn't going to get far with Deacons. The man had mercy in his soul, but a finite quantity of it. He felt he owed Mal something, even if it was just the kindness of a little food and water. Gotta go, Deacon said. I was told I could only give you a few licks. I'm gonna refrain from doing that, but if I stay any longer, people are bound to get suspicious. One thing, Mal said. I'm bursting for a pee. Bucket over there. Sure, but my hands are tied behind my back. Kinda makes it difficult for a fella to get the old pecker out, know what I mean? You want me to untie you? I ain't falling for that. You cold cock me for sure. Okay, but I'm gonna piss my pants if I don't do something about it right soon. You want that on your conscience? Deacons was in two minds, Mal could see. Man to man, he pressed, if the roles were reversed, I'd do the same for you. Swear. Tell you what, Deacons said. I'll unbutton your fly, but that's as far as it goes. You'll have to manage the rest by your own some. He fumbled gingerly with the front of Mal's pants, like someone fearful of touching a live wire. Mal then shuffled over to the bucket on his knees. He managed, through some awkward maneuvering and hip gyrating, to liberate the part of him that needed liberating. What followed was a full minute of blessed bladder-draining relief, after which, with a bit more wriggly dancing, he was able to stow everything away again back where it belonged. Thanks, Stu, he said sincerely as Deacons rebuttoned his fly. Don't mention it. Seriously, I mean it. I guess you couldn't see your way to slipping me a knife now? A gun even? No chance. Or you could just, you know, accidentally on purpose leave the door ajar. Not gonna happen. Stu, you do realize this is real bad company you're keeping, don't you? These people, these brown coats in name only, they ain't playing fair. They're crazy. Toby Finn especially. I know Toby from way back when. Yeah, he said as much. Said he used to run with you when he was a kid. Trusted you, loved you like a brother. And that's why you've been top of his list of turncoats for a long while. Backstabbing's all the more painful when it comes from someone you were once close to. Toby used to be a good kid. Don't know what turned him, but it's clear he's picked up some harum-scarum notions since then. That face of his? That's the face of a madman. Toby ain't someone I'd pledge my allegiance to, is what I'm saying. Someone as Feng Lei as that is liable to turn on the people around him at the drop of a hat. I don't reckon any of you's safe while you're around him. If he's calling me a traitor, I imagine he could do the same to anyone. All's it'd take is him getting some twisted fancy about you into his head, and that's it. You're next for the chop. Deacons appeared to take this on board. So you say. Think about it, at least, Mal said. I mean, come on. You're so scared of these people you'd thump a defenseless man just to keep in with them? What does that say about them? Or you? Deacons did not reply. Instead, with a heavy tread, he left the cell, shutting and locking the door behind him. Alone once more, Mal contemplated his situation. It looked bleak. Trying to turn Stuart Deacons against the rest of the vengeful browncoats had been a long shot. Mal might have planted a few seeds of doubt in the man's mind, but he doubted they would germinate into anything fruitful. His main hope, slender though it was the crew of Serenity. Somehow, against all the odds, they would find him. He had to believe that. The only alternative was utter despair. He sank back onto the floor and into reverie again. 22. After a sumptuous dinner of fresh vegetables and real chicken, Book took leave of Mika Wong. He hadn't wanted to stay for the meal. He had wanted to retrieve Elmira at Edema right away, but somehow it would have felt impolite to turn down Wong's hospitality, the more so since Wong had placed so much trust in him. And when might he next have the chance to eat such good, wholesome food? The soul got its sustenance from the Lord, but the body needed nourishment too. Book knew from experience that even a humble bowl of soup could make all the difference to a person. He caught a rickshaw back from the town outskirts into Evesdown proper. As the cart jolted along the neon-splashed streets, he fetched out his comlink and called Serenity. "Shepherd," Wash said. "Where are you? Are you all right? Do you have Mal?"
"I'm on Persephone still," he said. "I have news. Nothing directly pertinent to Mal himself, but news that's nonetheless encouraging." He filled Wash in on all he had learned from Wong about Elmira and Covington.
"That's good to hear," Wash said. "I can't escape the feeling that we're running short on time, though."
"Me either. How are things with you? Payload all safe?"
"Yeah, we've been making good headway. At least we were, only now we're being overhauled by an Alliance patrol cruiser, the IAV Stormfront."
"Not good."
"Definitely not. If it wasn't for bad luck, we wouldn't have any luck. They're hailing us, and I've been stalling them with the old communications interference trick. You know, oopsies, can't make out, try and say. That won't hold them for long, and just makes them more irate anyway."
"Are they after certain crew members?"
"Don't know, but we can't assume they're not, so we've taken appropriate action. I'm not going to say too much, just in case Stormfront's listening in. This channel's as secure as I can make it, but you never know. All I'll say is, we've relieved ourselves of excess personnel for now, and we're down to a shipboard complement of just four. Oh, hey, Mrs. Washburn wants a word."
Zoe came on the line.
"Shepard, I caught what you told Wash. What are your plans?"
"Seems like I can't expect you to return to Persephone in order to assist me, not under current circumstances."
"No, if we were to make a run for it, the patrol cruiser would open up on us for sure, and we'd be just so much floating debris. Do you think you could go it alone?"
"I could," Book said with a trace of hesitancy. "I wouldn't like to, though. I have no idea what kind of reception I might receive. I anticipate that Covington would not leave Elmira unguarded or his property undefended. One man could, I suppose, infiltrate the premises fairly successfully, if he had the right skills. But it'd be better if there were more of us, in case of unforeseen problems."
"What if you had reinforcements? I'm thinking we could kill two birds with one stone here."
"Tell me more."
"I'll contact Inara on her shuttle first, bring her up to speed, then patch you through to her, and you can take it from there. Wait one."
There was calm silence for 2 or 3 minutes. Book drummed his fingers agitatedly on the thin vinyl padding of the rickshaw seat. Patience was one of his strong suits, but even so, he had the unavoidable sense that every minute of delay was a minute Mal got further away and less easy to rescue.
The fact that an Alliance patrol cruiser was even now bearing down on Serenity was yet another blow to his inner calm. Sometimes life seemed like just one setback after another.
"Shepherd Book," said Inara.
"Go ahead, Inara. As you know, I have the TAMS on board. Shouldn't we be somewhat more circumspect in this conversation? A companion's shuttle has special multi-phase communications and ciphering programs that are impenetrable to practically every known decryption software. It enables me to conduct my business with absolute guaranteed discretion, a boon to my clientele." "I didn't know that."
"I'd be surprised if a man of your calling did," Inara said. "Our status is this. We've managed to pull away from Serenity without Stormfront detecting us. I know that because it hasn't rerouted. It's still on an intercept course with Serenity, less than 10 minutes away from docking distance. We started out by staying in Serenity's shadow. Then, as chance would have it, we passed an asteroid field. We've diverted towards the edge of the field and are laying low here. The asteroids are providing enough scanner disruption that Stormfront's instruments are unlikely to spot us. It should pass us right by.
Serenity's the bigger target anyway.
And the bigger prize. They're likely to be focusing on her to the exclusion of all else. What this means is that, assuming our luck holds and we remain undetected, we'll be out of range of Stormfront's scopes in about a half hour."
"And you could then head down to Persephone."
"Correct."
"At full burn, that'd get you here by..." Book glanced at his watch, then performed a swift mental calculation. 0600 hours local time.
"I know we're not the true cavalry," Inara said. "I know you'd be better off with Zoe and Jane backing you up. But in a pinch, we'll have to do."
Book had to admit to himself that he would have preferred it if the former browncoat corporal and the gruff mercenary were joining him on the raid on Covington's house, rather than a companion, a doctor, and whatever River was. A very damaged girl, a human time bomb, an escaped lab rat, all of these and more. Yes, he was looking at having 3 civilians backing him up when there was every likelihood he would need the 2 crew members with the most combat experience. On balance, that did not seem like a winning prospect. Instead of Serenity's big guns, he was making do with firecrackers. Book knew, however, that God provided. It might not always seem as though he did. Indeed, to the untrained eye, it sometimes looked as though the Lord's methods were just plain berserk. But in the end, all said and done, he always came through. It was a cornerstone of Book's belief, the rock he had rebuilt his life upon. "You 3 will be more than enough," he told Inara. "I'm certain of it." And he was. Almost. 23. The main vid screen flickered. An Alliance logo appeared, and a faceless, nameless baritone voice told Serenity to prepare for immediate docking and boarding of an authorized government inspection crew. Zoe could see Wash was not pleased at the prospect, but when he pushed his comm button to reply, he sounded downright bubbly.
"Great to see you guys. Sorry about all the trouble with transmissions earlier.
We got circuits sold and cranky on this boat. They keep telling me to get off their lawn and turn my music down. But you're here now, and that's just super. Protecting our way of life. Go Alliance!"
Serenity shuddered as the larger ship made contact. Once the airlocks had been lined up, the seals were secured. Wash turned to his wife.
"Okay, Zoe, it's your play. What do you have in mind?"
"Question: how sexy am I?"
Wash blinked. His eyes darted around apprehensively.
"Is this a trick? Just answer, scale of 1 to 10, how sexy am I?"
20, easy. Except when you're mad at someone, then it's a 15. Mad at me, a 12, but mostly 20.
She leaned over and kissed him, a full-on smacker that as soon as he had got over his bafflement, he reciprocated.
"Whoa," he said. "What was that all about?"
"A woman doesn't always need a reason to kiss her man."
Zoe then undid a couple of buttons on her shirt and opened it out to expose more cleavage than normal.
"You're going to seduce the feds?" Wash said.
"Not seduce, and not all of them, just the senior officer. Bamboozle him, throw him off his game if I can, get him to drop his guard.
That's assuming he's male and straight, which, given the Alliance's gender equality policy, is a fair assumption. Don't take this the wrong way, Zoe, but that doesn't really seem in your wheelhouse. In ours, yes, but yours? Don't take this the wrong way? His wife said, stiffening. How am I meant to take it? You're saying Inara is more attractive than I am? No, I am not saying anything of the sort. Don't be mad. It came out wrong. I take it back. Wash's voice rose in pitch until it was virtually a bat squeak. I'm just messing with you. Phew. You're right. I don't have Inara's skills. But never underestimate the power of a hair toss, a pair of big eyes, and showing off a little skin. Zoe pouted her lips and shimmied her shoulders. Worked on you after all, didn't it? Yeah, but I'm easy. Oh, Wash, she stroked his cheek. All men are. As she exited the bridge, he called out after her. Good luck, or not too much good luck. Maybe no luck. I don't know. Just don't do anything I wouldn't do, young lady, and be home by 10. Zoe chuckled. Okay, Dad. Jane joined her on the catwalk, descending into the cargo bay with her. You tidied up Simon and River's bunks like I asked? Zoe said. Clean as a nun's panties. Bedding and personal effects all stowed away. You wouldn't know anyone had been there. Good. Kaylee met them at the foot of the stairs. I just checked the crates, she said, talking in low, urgent tones. Something River said got me rattled. Ran a full spectrum diagnostic. Temperature, vibration, electromagnetic frequency, radiation, seal integrity. River was right, Lord knows how. Something's changed in those boxes. The contents are heating up. She made a face. Kaboom. What's our solution? Zoe asked briskly. Kaylee had a quick answer for that. Maybe we can cool down the cargo to slow down the reaction. Make it as cold as we can.
Seal off the hold and open the bay, Jane said with a gleam in his eye. Don't get much colder than space.
Great idea, Zoe said.
Yeah?
Jane sounded a little surprised. Zoe could only assume this was because it wasn't often his ideas were classified as great, or even listened to. Yes, but it's going to have to wait. We got company. She hit the switch to operate the cargo bay ramp. It had barely opened before a dozen strong Alliance team in full body armor and helmets marched into the cargo bay in lockstep. They fanned out, most with weapons drawn, and aimed towards Zoe, Jane, and Kaylee. A few carried compact, ruggedized flight cases. Zoe, Kaylee, and, most reluctantly, Jane, raised their hands in surrender.
Do not touch your weapons, the Alliance officer at the front of the pack said. We will disarm you ourselves.
As the other Alliance officers were seeing to that, their leader asked, Who's in charge here?
That'd be me, Zoe said. Zoe Washburn, acting captain of this here vessel.
And I'm Major Bernard of the IAV Stormfront.
He looked all three of them up and down, then said,
Is this your entire crew?
No, sir, Zoe said. Our pilot is still up in the bridge.
Get him or her down here on the double.
After Zoe relayed the order to Wash over the intercom, Major Bernard flashed his credentials at her so fast she couldn't read them. Not that she needed to. The patrol cruiser parked alongside Serenity was credentials aplenty.
By authority of the Union of Allied Planets, Bernard said in a monotone, I'll need access to all crew documentation and bills of lading on cargo presently carried aboard this ship. Also, vessel registration forms and tax licenses. Any attempt to conceal information or cargo will be punished to the fullest extent of the law. Are you carrying any passengers who are not crew?
No, sir, Zoe said. This is not a passenger ship.
He looked around at the largely bare cargo bay.
Did you just offload a consignment, or is this the state of your business?
It comes and goes, sir, Zoe replied.
Usually goes, she added inwardly.
While I'm checking the paperwork, my team will run a routine search of the entire ship.
A search for what?
Kaylee said, all wide-eyed innocence.
Contraband or undocumented individuals, Bernard said.
Then his eyes narrowed and he addressed all three of them.
This can't be your first rodeo. You know exactly what we do. Don't want anyone touching Vera with their dirty paws, Jane growled under his breath. She don't like it.
Vera, said Bernard, there's a fifth person on board?
Nope, she's a gun. Got the license for her and everything, before you ask.
Major Bernard did a double take. You name your... Never mind. All the paperwork you want is stowed in the galley, Zoe said. Then, flicking a lock of her hair behind her ear and lowering her voice suggestively, she said, You'd be most comfortable working in there, Major. You can spread everything out on the dining table. I can even make you some tea if you'd like.
The change in her tone and attitude was not lost on Bernard. A small smile broke his blunt, coarse features.
That's most accommodating of you, Acting Captain Washburn, he said. As he and Zoe made for the dining area, Bernard's subordinates began opening their flight cases and taking out multiple reading scanners whose infrared setting Zoe knew could pick up the body heat of a fruit fly through 10 feet of vanadium steel. Bernard sat himself down at the dining table and Zoe spread out the documents in front of him.
Hmm, he said. According to the registration, this ship has 2 shuttles, but on approach, we saw both bays are currently empty. Where are your shuttles, Acting Captain Washburn?
Please, call me Zoe.
Very well.
Again, that small smile accompanied by a tiny, avid glint in the eye. Major Bernard was not a handsome man, but he was, it seemed, vain enough to think that a woman like Zoe might be attracted to him. She noted the wedding band on his left hand. She noted, too, that he was making some effort to hide it from her.
I'll repeat the question, Zoe. Where are your shuttles?
We've had bad luck with shuttles lately, she told him. Had to leave them both on Whitefall. They're awaiting spare parts for necessary refitting.
Kind of risky going into the black without one, don't you think?
Risk is built into the price for our services, she said. Wash appeared in the dining room doorway. His strawberry blonde hair was sticking up every which way like he had just rolled out of bed, but then it always looked like that.
I was told someone needed to see me, he said. Went down to the cargo bay, but got sent up here.
Major Bernard stared grimly at Wash's eye-searingly colorful Hawaiian shirt and the toy dinosaur poking a toothy head out of his breast pocket.
Who might you be? Bernard said.
Hoban Washburn, pilot, husband. Then, remembering Zoe's plan, Wash said,
But not husband to this lady, no sir.
Bernard frowned.
But you have the same surname.
Brother and sister, Wash said. Zoe shot him a scowl over Bernard's head.
Adopted, brother and sister, Wash amended.
It's funny, though. People often tell us how much we look alike.
They do, said Bernard, peering from Wash to Zoe and back again.
Act alike, at any rate. Similar mannerisms, similar gestures.
Wash attempted to mimic a typical Zoe-esque posture, cocking a hip and resting his thumbs in his belt. He also widened his eyes in emulation of her naturally large eyes, although whereas on her it looked captivating, on him it looked just plain demented.
Like twins, some say.
Hoban, said Zoe, deliberately using his given name rather than his nickname, as a sister might. Major Bernard doesn't need to know any of that. Major Bernard is a busy man. Isn't that so, Major?
Aubrey, said Bernard.
Huh?
I call you Zoe? You call me Aubrey.
Sure thing, Aubrey.
Zoe bit back a laugh.
Aubrey?
So, Hoban, why don't you just hurry on back to the bridge? She made a waggling wave with her fingers. Assuming Aubrey doesn't need to discuss anything with you, that is.
I have just one question, Bernard said to Wash. What was your course prior to boarding?
Wash told him the truth. He had no choice. It was all down in black and white on the manifest they got from Badger, which Bernard now held.
That would be for delivery of 5 crates of mining chemicals?
Bernard scanned over the bill of lading.
On Aberdeen?
Wash nodded.
Very well, said Bernard. That's all I need to know. You're dismissed, Mr. Washburn.
Okay, bye for now, sis, Wash said to Zoe. See you later. He sauntered off, doing his best impersonation of Zoe's confident take-no-prisoners gait.
Strange fellow, Bernard remarked. Hard to believe the two of you are related.
Well, we're not, are we? Zoe said.
not by blood. My parents took him in after his own parents rejected him.
I can see why they might have. His parents, I mean. Yours, not so much.
Growing up, he was always a doofus. Hasn't changed a great deal, but never mind him, Aubrey. You keep examining that paperwork. I think you'll find it's all in order, but it never hurts to have someone cast an expert eye over it.
She braced both arms on the table, leaning close to the Alliance officer, so close that a stray strand of her hair brushed his cheek.
Oh, I'm sorry, she said in a not-sorry voice.
No problem, Zoe.
Bernard gave every appearance of concentrating on the documents, but she could tell his mind wasn't fully on the task. Every once in a while, he darted a quick sideways glance at her, taking in her arm, the curve of her bosom, the profile of her face. Finally, he pronounced himself satisfied. Registration code numbers on the engine manifolds are correct. Documentation all checks out. Guess I'd better have a look at the labels and seals on those crates of chemicals, just to be completely sure. They left the dining room, Zoe leading the way. She was conscious of Bernard's gaze on her backside and walked with a little extra wiggle for his benefit. Her injured leg accentuated the motion. Jane and Kaylee were still where she had left them, down in the cargo bay. Wash was there, too. Jane looked ill-tempered as always, but was trying to rein in his disgruntlement. Kaylee, by contrast, was an open book. She wrung her hands and gnawed her lower lip. As for Wash, he could put on a poker face when he needed to.
HTX-20, Major Bernard said, walking around the crates, but giving them a wide berth. Satan's Snowflakes, they call it. That's some seriously hazardous cargo you've got there.
It's what we do, Aubrey, Zoe said. There's a premium on hazardous.
Bernard waved his subordinates over. See if you can't shift them out of the way, he said. I want to know what's under them. Zoe and Kaylee traded glances. Kaylee said,
Sir, these crates should not be moved. The contents are highly volatile.
Bernard wheeled around, one eyebrow raised. If they're that dangerous, then why are they sitting in your hold without proper protection?
They didn't used to be so volatile.
Move them, Bernard ordered. The Alliance officers tried, but they couldn't lift the crates, and they couldn't slide them across the deck either. They were just too heavy to budge. With every grunting abortive attempt, the four crew members flinched. Bernard turned to Zoe. He pointed at a forklift parked along the wall.
Does that thing work?
Kaylee made a little involuntary squeak.
What do you think's under there?
Jane said, clearly on the verge of losing his couth and his cool.
How dumb do you think we are?
I don't know how dumb you personally are, Bernard said. By the looks of it, pretty dumb. Jane's lips curled back from his teeth.
Zoe, on the other hand, Bernard continued, strikes me as an intelligent and discerning woman, which is why I'm asking myself how she could just let these crates sit here if their contents are really so unstable, which in turn leads me to wonder whether they mightn't be hiding something and someone's hoping we won't dare move them.
I'll move them, Wash said agreeably. Zoe watched as Wash climbed onto the repaired forklift, started it up, and with a grinding crunch, jammed it in reverse. Showing off his exceptional driving skills, he nearly backed over Bernard's foot. Would have done if Zoe hadn't nudged the Alliance officer out of the path of the rear wheel.
Ah, sorry about that, Wash said sheepishly as he squealed the brakes. Accelerator sticks a bit.
He surged forward, dropping the fork so low it sent sparks flying off the deck. With a reckless nonchalance, he scraped under and scooped up the nearest crate. Zoe was holding her breath. Jane turned away, a scowl on his face. Kaylee looked plain desperate.
Where do you want it?
Wash asked as he raised the huge box, teetering to eye level.
Anywhere, Bernard said.
As Wash reversed away with the crate, Major Bernard seemed disappointed to find no trap door hidden underneath. There was nothing but solid, bolted-down deck plate.
Move the others, he told Wash.
But it was the same story there.
Bernard watched as his men tested the deck plates with their scanner wands, looking for voids that could hold contraband and stowaways. When they were done, they shook their heads.
"Ship is clean, sir," one of them reported. Then he added hopefully, "A bit too clean, maybe?"
Zoe chortled merrily. "Oh, hush. Don't you listen to him, Aubrey," she said, resting a hand on Bernard's forearm. "How can a ship be too clean? It's ridiculous." Her hand lingered. Major Bernard made no effort to dislodge it. Weighing up the evidence of his own eyes and factoring in the obvious allure he held for Zoe, he came to a decision. He scribbled something on the bottom of the manifest, then stamped it with his official stamp. "We appreciate your compliance and courtesy," he said to Zoe. "You are good to go. We'll be out of your way shortly."
"Excellent work," Wash said, beaming at Bernard. "Very efficient. Very thorough. A credit to the Alliance."
"Pleasure to make your acquaintance, Zoe," Bernard said, giving her a particularly snappy salute.
"Likewise, I'm sure, Aubrey."
The boarding team left the crew's weapons piled on the dining table and made a dignified single-file exit. As the ramp closed behind them, Wash sidled over to Zoe.
"I've got to say, Zoe, seeing that performance of yours just now, I don't know whether I'm turned on or should start filing for divorce. Did Aubrey give you his wave address? You two planning on seeing each other again, or was this a one-time thing?"
"You know I only have eyes for you, husband.
I was thinking maybe we could play being brother and sister again sometime to, you know, spice things up in the bedroom."
"Don't push it, Buster," Zoe said, giving him a whack on the arm that left him wincing and rubbing the affected area for a minute afterwards. It took 10 minutes for IAV Stormfront to undock. By then, Wash was back up in the bridge. When Serenity was clear of the cruiser's exhaust, he fired a single pulse of the engines and gentled her away in the opposite direction Inara had flown.
"We've got to do something about those crates," Kaylee said to Zoe. "It can't wait. If they're overheating, there's only one solution I can see. Jane's idea. We strap them down and blow the atmo. Hard vacuum will bring down their temperature in no time."
"What if that doesn't work?"
"We jettison them out into space," Zoe said.
She hated even thinking it, let alone voicing it. The crew were already so broke, but better broke than incinerated.
"If we lose our cargo," Jane said, "we might as well quit flying."
Zoe rounded on him. "You care to rephrase that?"
He shrugged. "Choice mightn't be ours anyway. We won't have the coin we need to keep this boat in the sky." She kept glaring at him, but he was only saying what she was thinking. She said, "Strap down the crates, fast, and keep your mouth shut."
"This is not our best day," Jane muttered under his breath.
Zoe thought of Mal. Wherever he had gotten to, she reckoned he was having an even worse day.
24.
Inara had seen larger, grander houses in her time, but Hunter Covington's mansion was impressive nonetheless. It was wedding cake white and sprawled over two stories, with Doric columns rising to the roof all along its front elevation, creating a broad, shaded porch area. 20 rooms in the main building at least, she thought, along with a barn-like stable block to one side and a wing adjoining the rear, which, to judge by the comparative plainness of its exterior, most likely housed the servants' quarters. The grounds were impressive, too, if for no other reason than the greenness of the neatly trimmed lawns and shrubbery. The surrounding landscape was arid and harshly brown, dotted here and there with vegetation, but more or less desert. To use so much water in such a parched region to irrigate a garden was costly and profligate. It was early, but in the cool of the morning, a gardener was already outdoors clipping a hedge. He paused from his labors to watch Inara go past. Not 5 minutes earlier, her shuttle had put down in front of the property. The gardener had been curious about that, but not as curious as he was to see a woman who was clearly a companion sashaying forth. He touched a finger to the brim of his sun hat. Inara rewarded him with one of her best and brightest smiles. She walked up a short flight of steps to the front door, which opened before she had even got a hand to the bell push. The person on the other side was not some valet or butler, she knew that at a glance.
He was a slab-faced bodyguard type with a gun on his hip and an insolent seen-it-all look about him.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
"Inara Serra. I'm expected."
"You sure as hell ain't. Nobody's expected."
Her forehead puckered into the slightest of frowns. "To whom am I speaking?"
"Who I am ain't none of your business, lady," said the bodyguard.
"Well, is Mr. Covington home?"
"Mr. Covington ain't home."
She looked flustered. "There must be some misunderstanding. I have an appointment with him this morning, 8 a.m. sharp. My credentials." She showed him her companion license and registration, etched with the insignia of House Madrasa. The bodyguard had already figured out her occupation for himself and gave the documents only a cursory glance. "He's really not in?" she said.
"Off planet on business. You sure you have an appointment? Only Mr. Covington, he don't consort with companions, best I know. He has himself alternative outlets for his needs, if you get what I'm saying. Must be there's been some kind of mix-up."
Inara was now doing an impersonation of someone very confused and not a little indignant. "Mistakes like this simply don't happen. I had a firm engagement with Mr. Covington at this hour. It was made over a month ago, and I've traveled a long way to be here. If he was going to cancel, he ought to have let me know in advance. I've a good mind to report him to the guild over this. Wasting my time. He'll be fined at the very least, and if I have my way, he'll be blackballed as well."
"Yeah, well. Sorry about that,"
said the bodyguard unapologetically. Inara insinuated herself into the doorway so that he could not easily close the door on her. "May I make a small request?" He didn't say no, so she continued. "I've been in my shuttle nearly 3 days straight. The water tanks are running low, and frankly, I could do with freshening up. Is there a bathroom nearby I could use? I promise I won't be more than 5 minutes. You'd be doing me such a favor." No one was impervious to Inara Serra's charm when she turned it on full blast. Age, gender, sexual inclination, professional obligation, none of it made any difference. A person's inner barriers simply melted like ice under a blowtorch. The bodyguard could have no more refused her request than he could have forbidden the tide from turning or the sun from setting.
"I don't know.
Please?" Whatever last few misgivings he had evaporated.
"Okay, it's down this way. Follow me."
"You're too kind. Do you have a name?"
"Walter."
"Walter, you're too kind." Walter couldn't help himself. A smile of appreciation plucked at the corners of his meaty mouth. Inara entered a huge hallway with a curved sweeping staircase and teak floorboards polished to such a gleam they dazzled the eyes. The downstairs bathroom had gold and marble fittings. Inara ran the faucets a while and made some minor adjustments to her elaborate kabuki-inflected makeup in the mirror. She was steeling herself for what she had to do next. Walter the bodyguard was waiting right outside as she re-emerged. "I'll be leaving now," she said. "Do tell Mr. Covington that I was disappointed to have missed him. I'm still unhappy about the unannounced cancellation, but your courtesy, Walter, has gone a long way to allaying my feelings of offense. Oh, you appear to have something on your neck. A speck of lint, it looks like. May I?" Not allowing him to grant permission or even to try to remove the lint himself, Inara reached up and brushed the side of his thick neck. Walter touched the spot where her fingers had just been. A small knot formed between his eyebrows.
"Feels odd," he said. "Like my skin's gone numb."
"A companion's touch has been known to have all sorts of effects," Inara said.
"Yeah, but this ain't—"
His eyes swam in their sockets. His body swayed.
"What the hell'd you just do to me, you witch?"
he said slurringly. "It's a fast-acting skin contact sedative, Walter. An hour from now, you'll wake up with a raging headache and a powerful thirst, but otherwise unharmed." He made to grab for her, but the action was feeble and uncoordinated. His legs were buckling under him. He could barely stay standing. "Companions have these little tricks," Inara continued, "in case a client gets aggressive or otherwise fails to observe the rules. Now, why don't you just sit down over there?"
She guided him towards a gilt chair, more comfortable than simply collapsing to the floor. Walter sat heavily, his eyelids drooped, his head sagged.
Can never trust a whore.
The words trailed off to be replaced by deep snoring. And because you called me that, Inara said to his unconscious form, I have even fewer qualms about doing what I just did. She peeled off the oval-shaped transparent patch on the tip of her index finger. It was an impermeable membrane coated on one side with a dose of the sedative. All of the drug should have transferred itself to Walter, but she was careful nonetheless as she rolled up the membrane and slipped it into a pocket. At that moment, a maid entered the hallway carrying a stack of folded towels. She took one look at Inara and at the slumped, snoozing Walter, and her face fell in astonishment. She seemed on the brink of yelling. Inara hurried towards her, adopting a mask of anxiety. Help me, she said. This man just collapsed. I don't know what's happened. I think he's unwell. The maid was unconvinced. I don't know who you are, lady, or what you're doing here, but we're told to be wary of all strangers, even fancily dressed ones. I imagine so. For what it's worth, I mean you no harm. That said, I can't have you screaming the house down either. She was now only arm's distance from the maid. There was no time for finesse or subtlety. She struck her a blow to the carotid with the edge of her hand like a sideways axe chop. The blow briefly interrupted the blood supply to the maid's brain and stunned her temporarily. Long enough for Inara to deliver a second deftly aimed jab to the vagus nerve in her neck. Instant insensibility ensued. Inara caught the maid as she fell, then dragged her to the doorway through which she had entered. In a laundry room, amid shelves piled high with clothes and fresh linen, she laid the maid out on the floor, then went back into the hallway to fetch the towels the woman had dropped. She rolled up one of them and placed it beneath the maid's head. Like Walter, the maid would wake up with a headache, but at least a stiff neck wouldn't be a problem. Compassion was one of a companion's strongest suits, even when it came to visiting violence on others.
25. While Inara infiltrated the mansion itself, Shepherd Book was moving stealthily around the perimeter of the grounds. He had no idea where Almira Adedima was being kept on the premises, so his only option was reconnaissance. With Inara busy indoors distracting and neutralizing whatever security personnel Hunter Covington employed, Book crept along, keeping low behind the three-bar fence that encircled the property and studying the building from all angles. He reasoned that Covington would have Almira under lock and key in an upstairs room in order to make it that much harder for her to escape. To that end, he surveilled the house's upper story, looking for a window that was shuttered or barred, or both. The sound of a twig snapping behind him brought him whirling around. His stun gun was in his hand, fully charged and primed. Book almost pulled the trigger to unleash the electrified dart that would deliver a 50,000-volt shock. River? River Tam stood there, swinging her arms from side to side. I thought we told you to stay in the shuttle with Simon.
Simon wasn't looking, so I came out, River said, to help you.
You're no help to me here, Book said gently but with a forceful undertone. This is something Inara and I have to do. You're best off keeping out of sight with your brother.
I know where she is.
What?
The woman, Almira. She's in there.
River pointed, straight-armed, towards the stable block. Just as Book was asking himself how River could know this, and be so certain about it too, Simon came scurrying up.
River, he hissed. You shouldn't have run away. I've been looking all over for you. Here I am, she said simply. You found me. Sorry, Shepherd. I'll take her back to the shuttle. No harm done, I hope.
Wait just a moment, son, Book said. River, are you sure that's where Almira is?
River nodded. Uh-huh. I can see her. She's sad. She's chained up, straw in her hair. She knows she's going to die. Hunter's mad at her. She sold him out, he says.
I'm going to fix you, woman.
River's voice had suddenly taken on a gravel roughness and a masculine note.
See if I don't.
When I come back, I'm going to show you what happens to bitches that snitch to the authorities. They get cut, all over, every part of their body. Every part. Cut till they bleed to death, but slow, days long slow.
And she knows he's going to do it, too. Her voice had reverted to normal. He's not a man to lie about such things.
Where precisely in the stable block is she? River, if she was correct about Elmira's location, had just saved Book a considerable amount of time and effort. The stable block would have been the last place he looked.
Easier if I show you.
Book looked at Simon, then at his sister, then back to Simon.
Are you asking my permission? Simon said.
Preferably, but even if I don't, River's coming with me.
Simon debated inwardly. Then I'm coming too. I already let her out of my sight once. I'm not doing it a second time. Who knows what we could be walking into?
Book did not like having two people tagging along with him. One was bad enough. But he respected Simon's decision and his concern for his sister's welfare. All right, just please stay out of the way. Leave the rough stuff to me.
Here we go.
River was already striding off towards the stable block. Book hurried to catch up, Simon at his heels.
Off to see the horses.
They were halfway there when River said to Book,
By the way, there's a man just inside the doorway. He hasn't seen us yet. You have 10 seconds before he does.
Again, Book wondered how the girl could have such knowledge. Those Dr. Frankensteins at the Academy had bestowed talents on her that were preternatural. They were even, although it seemed a mildly blasphemous thought, godlike. But he didn't have time to dwell on it. He broke into a sprint, running towards the stable block as fast as his aged limbs would let him. Book was, in fact, in phenomenally good shape for a man of his advanced years. Keeping himself that way through a routine of isometric strengthening exercises and abstinence from alcohol and narcotics. Within 5 seconds, he had covered the 30 yards between him and the stable block door. 2 seconds later, he was inside the building and confronting the man stationed on guard duty, who was in the process of rising from the chair he'd been sitting on and raising the rifle that had been lying across his knees. The stun gun crackled in Book's hand. The guard tumbled to the ground, juddering like he was doing some kind of wild horizontal dance routine. His teeth were bared. An eerie, strangulated ululation escaped his throat. A wet patch spread across the crotch of his jeans.
There's another one, River said from the doorway.
Book wheeled to see a second guard appear from the shadows of one of the loose boxes. He was drawing his pistol. Book hit the switch on the stun gun to detach the wire linking it to the dart hooked in the first guard's chest. The gun was a two-shot deal, but it required closer range than he currently had. The second guard was a good 5 yards too far away. Book had no choice but to duck down and charge towards him, hoping he could bridge the gap in time. The guard was cocking his gun, however, and drawing a bead on Book. Book knew with a dreadful certainty that he was going to be too slow. The guard was going to shoot him before he could get him with the stun gun. A horseshoe whirled like a discus over Book's head. It clouded the guard in the face just above one eyebrow with an audible crunch. The man dropped as though he had walked slap bang into an invisible wall. Book glanced around to see River looking very pleased with herself, clapping her hands in glee. Nice shot, he said.
I love playing horseshoes, River said. I was always good at it, better than Simon.
She picked up another horseshoe from the dust at her feet. It and the one she had thrown must have been just lying around spare.
If he gets up again, I'll just hit him again.
You do that. Where's Elmira?
Who? Oh, her, yes.
The girl tapped her lips, pondering.
Up there.
She gestured towards a hayloft.
Straw in her hair.
Book shinned up a stepladder that led to the hayloft. The horses were stamping softly and whinnying in their loose boxes below, disturbed by the uncustomary activities of the humans in the stables. If luck was on Book's side or some higher power, the beasts would not become so agitated as to draw the attention of people in the house. As his head rose above the level of the hayloft floor, he peered cautiously around. There might well be a third guard on duty.
but there was nobody in the hayloft save for a young woman chained to a support post with a piece of cloth tied tight around her mouth to form a gag. Her clothing was ripped and torn. Her hair was disheveled, and yes, as River had said, there were bits of straw in it, sticking out at all angles like pins from a pincushion. She had bruises and grazes all over, and she looked terrified. As Book appeared, Elmira Adedima began to writhe and scream despite the gag. He put a finger to his lips and smiled reassuringly. "I'm not here to hurt you, Elmira," he said. "I'm here to help." Her expression was distrustful, but she did calm down somewhat. "Miko Wong sent me." "Only the slightest distortion of the truth. My friends and I are going to get you out of here." Mention of Wong's name appeared to settle the matter as far as Elmira was concerned. Book undid the gag. Elmira worked her jaw to ease the kinks out. The gag had been on so long it had left red welts.
"Who are you?" she croaked.
"All in good time," Book said. "First order of business, getting these chains off you." The chains were secured with a padlock. Book studied it for a moment, then shrugged. It had the simplest kind of lever and ward mechanism. He could have opened it in 30 seconds with a paperclip or a hair grip, but luckily he could do better than that. From his satchel, he took out a compact, leather-bound Bible. Concealed within the binding in a recess beneath a marbled endpaper that could be detached was a comprehensive set of lockpicks. He selected one that, in his judgment, matched this brand of padlock and corresponded to the genuine key in length. He inserted it into the slot, feeling its teeth fit snugly against the actuators. He'd gauged right. A single clockwise twist of the wrist and the padlock shackle fell open.
"A shepherd?" said Elmira. "Who can pick a lock?"
"And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven," Book said, stowing the lockpick back inside the Bible and the book itself back in his satchel. "And whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Matthew chapter 16, verse 19. He unwrapped the chains from around her wrist and helped her to her feet. "Can you walk?" he asked.
"I think so," said Elmira.
"Then let's go. Time is of the essence."
26. Outside the stable block, Simon Tam was keeping watch. His specialty was medicine, however, not sentry duty. He didn't see the armed man stealing up on him from around the corner of the stable block. He wasn't even aware of his presence until the man pounced on him from behind, snaking an arm around his throat. The barrel of a gun dug into Simon's temple.
"Don't move," the man growled, "unless you want your brains spattered all over that there fancy vest of yourn."
"Please, don't shoot," Simon stammered.
"Don't give me no excuse to. State your business, quick about it."
I'm a guest of Hunter Collington's, good friend of his. Arrived just this morning. I'm only taking a stroll around, admiring the spread."
"Hunter who?"
"Your boss, Hunter Collington."
The man chuckled gratingly.
"I have a boss, but his name ain't Collington. You maybe want to try that again?"
"Covington," Simon exclaimed. He could have kicked himself. What a rookie mistake, getting the surname wrong. He just wasn't cut out for this sort of clandestine stuff. Nothing in his upbringing or education had prepared him for a life of skullduggery and violence. "Slip of the tongue, I meant Covington."
"A so-called good friend of Mr. Covington's wouldn't have gotten his name wrong, pal. I don't reckon you know him at all. I reckon you're some kind of spy or something. We're under orders to be on the lookout for intruders, anyone sneaking around looking suspicious. I'd say you fit the bill. Now tell me the truth. You got until the count of three, and then it's brain surgery by bullet. One, two."
River drifted out of the stable block, hands behind her back.
"Hey, Simon, who's your friend?"
Simon felt the man holding him stiffen in surprise.
"Where'd you come from, girl?"
"In there," River said. "I was just stroking the horses. They have such soft noses. Did you know that? Apart from the bristles. And their breath when they snort. It's warm on your hand. I like it. It smells of friendliness. She took a step towards the man and Simon. The gun moved from Simon's head, swiveling towards River.
Best you stay where you are, the man said to her. I got plenty of rounds in this thing, and I only need one for the each of you.
Simon's breath caught in his throat. With the tiniest twitch of his head, he tried to indicate to River that she should stop moving. Whether she saw the instruction or not, River halted. She twirled one foot, drawing circles in the dust with the toe cap of her boot. The man with the gun looked down at what she was doing. When he looked up again, River had brought both hands out in front of her. The right held a horseshoe. In one blindingly swift action, she flung it at the man. It connected with his gun hand, knocking the weapon out of his grasp. Before he was able to collect his wits, River sprang. Simon stumbled aside as River and the man went crashing to the ground. Straddling her opponent's torso, she rained punches on his face and ribcage in such a rapid flurry that her arms were twin blurs, like the pistons on a locomotive pumping at full speed. The man was utterly unable to defend or deflect. Within seconds, River had rendered him unconscious. Still, she kept up the barrage of blows until Simon laid a hand on her shoulder. River, you've done it. He's out cold. Keep that up and you might kill him. He was going to kill you, she said. And me. Fair's fair. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a candy for a candy, a penny for your thoughts. Still, and all, we don't kill unless we have to. River reflected on this, then smiled brightly. Okay, that's a good rule. I like to think so. She picked herself up and dusted herself off. Oh, hi, Shepherd, and Straw and Hair Lady. Book had just come out of the stable block, one arm around Elmira Adedema to support her. He cast a glance at the man on the ground.
No problems here, I take it?
None that couldn't be dealt with, Simon said.
Then let's make haste. Covington seems to have an endless supply of thugs, and I've no idea if we've met them all yet.
Inara saw them from a window. River, Simon, and Book with Elmira hurrying across the front lawn. She herself had been conducting a painstaking search of the first floor rooms, ever keeping an ear out for bodyguards or servants to avoid any further run-ins. It seemed she had been looking in vain. Elmira had been elsewhere. Inara made her way back to the front door and out into the daylight. She greeted the others with a wave, joining them on the driveway that led towards her shuttle.
A companion too? Elmira said. Who are you people?
Right now, Book said, you're liberators, and hopefully in a few minutes once we've made good our escape, we're going to be the recipients of some crucial intelligence from you, namely the whereabouts of your bondholder.
I can tell you that right now, Elmira said. Hunter isn't on Persephone anymore. He departed last night on his private yacht after doing some business over in Evesdown.
Do you know where he's gone?
Yes, he was boasting to me about it only yesterday, up there in the hayloft. He'd just been using me.
Her mouth downturned in a grimace of disgust.
You mean abusing, said Inara.
Yes, well, same difference. And then he told me he was going away, but when he came back, he'd
cut you, said River. Cut you till you bled to death, but slow, days long slow.
Yes, said Elmira, startled.
His exact words. How do you know he said that? Have you been speaking to him?
Never mind how we know, said Book. Where is he?
He was off to meet up with some associates. Bunch of renegades, I think. One time brown coats, now working some new angle. Hunter's been dealing with them quite some while, providing them with intel and such. It's what Wong wanted me to find out about, why he had me come back and infiltrate Hunter's operation.
Vigilantes?
Yeah, I guess you could call them that.
By now the group had reached the shuttle. Inara looked back towards the house, half expecting to see pursuers emerging. It seemed that the alarm had yet to be raised. River climbed aboard first, followed by Simon. Inara went next, extending a helping hand to Elmira. Book was last, and as soon as they were all safely ensconced in the shuttle, Inara darted over to the controls and started the engine cycling.
So he met the vigilantes in Evesdown, and then what?
Book said to Elmira, raising his voice above the steadily mounting whine of power coming from the thrusters. Then he was going to follow them to their destination. Seems as though they had plans to take some guy captive in Evesdown, subject him to a trial, and then hang him. They paid Hunter to help them nab the man. That's what they've been doing for quite a while, all across the verse. They track down people they believe betrayed the independent cause in some way or other, run them through a kangaroo court, then execute them. Inara's stomach knotted. Mal. Over her shoulder, she said, "Did you just say execute?" "I'm afraid so," said Elmira. "Hunter's gone to watch. They invited him along and he accepted. It doesn't pay to turn down a client's request, not if you want to work with them again in future. Plus, I imagine he's curious to see the end result, in case you hadn't appreciated. He ain't a nice man. Got a cruel streak in him a mile wide." "You sound as though you speak from experience," said Simon. She gave him a hard, steady look. "I most certainly do. I can show you the scars if you like. I'll say this for Hunter. He's a sadist, but a careful one. Never leaves marks where people will see them. But that still means there are plenty of places where he can leave them." She began unbuttoning her blouse until Simon stopped her. Mumbling an apology, he turned away. Point made, she did the buttons back up. "Now, Elmira," said Book, "I know you've been through a lot, but I want you to be very clear about this. That man you're talking about, the one the vigilantes are going to kill, is a friend of ours."
"Oh my God, I'm so very sorry."
"It's okay. All I want from you now is where they've taken him. Wherever Covington is headed, you have to understand how important this is to us." The shuttle rose from the ground with a lurch, pitching forward until its nose was almost scraping the dirt. Inara corrected, too preoccupied to worry if their ascent was perfectly smooth or not. A ricocheting bullet snapped off the shuttle's hull with a spang. To the people inside, it sounded like a mallet blow. Two men were running out of the mansion, toting rifles. The alarm had been raised at last, it would appear. They were both firing at a run, which meant their shooting was far from accurate. Not only that, but they must know their rounds would not penetrate the skin of a spacecraft designed with sufficient armoring to protect it from micrometeors and other small colliding objects. Presumably, they thought it was better to waste the bullets than have to admit to Covington later that they'd done nothing whatsoever to prevent the shuttle taking off. Inara poured on speed. The shuttle veered away from the mansion in a wide, yawing arc.
"Hades," Elmira said. "They're on Hades."
28. Kaylee looked for work to occupy her mind. There was no end of that to be found aboard Serenity, but the distraction of a simple involving task wasn't always sufficient. As she started lubricating a flanged coupler gasket on the transverse manipulator hose, digging her fingers into a bucket of grease, the cogs in her head resumed their unhappy circular turning. After Serenity had been flying for an hour with the cargo bay door wide open, Kaylee and Jane had donned spacesuits and gone down to check on the condition of the payload. Exposed to the negative 270 degrees Celsius chill of the deep black, ambient condensation now coated everything in the cargo bay. Every surface, every